In 1919, a young black veteran returned home from World War I, still wearing his uniform. He had fought for democracy in Europe, yet on an Alabama street corner, a white mob stripped him of his dignity and nearly his life for daring to wear that uniform with pride. This wasn't an isolated incident. It was the summer 83 black Americans were lynched when the nation erupted in 25 race riots. Yet from this violence emerged something unexpected. Not submission, but a cultural revolution that would transform American identity forever. Harlem became ground zero for this transformation, where artists, musicians, writers, and athletes gathered with a radical mission to prove through excellence what laws refused to acknowledge, that Black Americans were nobody's inferiors. Think of Harlem in the 1920s as existing in two parallel dimensions. There was Oz Harlem, the glittering fantasy land where white tourists flocked to the Cotton Club, watching black performers while being served exclusively by white waiters. This was what one observer called a racist's Disneyland, where black excellence existed purely for white entertainment. Then there was Daily Harlem, where real families raised children, where intellectuals debated in bookstores on 7th Avenue, where jazz musicians practiced in cramped apartments before their evening performances. What transformed this neighborhood from an upper-middle-class white enclave into Black America's cultural capital? Between 1915 and 1930, 2 million Southern blacks fled north in what became known as the Great Migration. They weren't just fleeing Jim Crow, they were running toward opportunity. The boll weevil had devastated Southern cotton crops, destroying thousands of black farmers' livelihoods. World War I created massive Northern labor shortages, with factories offering wages nearly double Southern rates. The Chicago Defender portrayed the North as a promised land, and thousands answered that call. Every revolution needs its philosophers. W.E.B. Du Bois, Harvard-educated and brilliant, challenged Booker T. Washington's accommodationist approach through his talented 10th concept, the idea that elite-educated black leaders could lift the entire race. In The Souls of Black Folk, he articulated double consciousness, the internal war of being both black and American in a society refusing to fully recognize either identity. Charles S. Johnson, as editor of Opportunity magazine, transformed cultural infrastructure through legendary dinner parties at his 135th Street apartment where black writers met white publishers. He believed African Americans could win sympathy by sheer force of the humanity and beauty of their own story. When political doors closed, he opened cultural windows, each artistic achievement becoming a weapon against the old racial stereotypes. James Weldon Johnson, Renaissance man who founded a high school at 24, edited America's first black daily newspaper, and served as American consul, articulated the movement's goal. The final measure of the greatness of all peoples is the amount and standard of the literature and art they have produced. This wasn't vanity, it was survival. The writers brought the fire. Jesse Redmond Faucett, a Cornell Phi Beta Kappa graduate, nurtured talents like Langston Hughes while producing 77 works, including the Renaissance's first novel. Claude McKay rejected talented 10th elitism. His poem, If We Must Die, written after the 1919 riots, demanded dignity through defiance. Like men will face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying but fighting back. McKay, Hughes, and Wallace Thurman refused to sanitize black reality for any audience. This tension between polished excellence and raw authenticity defined the Renaissance's internal debates. Should black artists master European forms or celebrate distinctly black expressions? The answer was both. County Cullen wrote sonnets rivaling any European poet, while Zora Neale Hurston celebrated black vernacular speech, proving black culture contained multitudes. Louis Armstrong captured it. What we play is life. When jazz exploded into 1920s Harlem, it fundamentally altered how America experienced rhythm and emotion. Renaissance intellectuals like Du Bois initially dismissed it as lowbrow, but younger artists like Hughes recognized jazz as revolutionary, a distinctly black art form that didn't seek white approval. Jazz's lineage stretched to 711 CE when Moorish general Tariq ibn Ziyad brought African rhythms into European culture. Through Spain's conquest, the slave trade, and Caribbean colonization, emerged one of music's most joyous forms. In New Orleans, Congo Square, African polyrhythms met European harmonies, creating something entirely new. The piano became particularly symbolic, with pioneers like Jelly Roll Morton and Fats Waller transforming it into a vehicle for Black musical expression. On March 28, 1939, the New York Renaissance Big Five faced the all-white Oshkosh All-Stars in Chicago for the first-ever World Professional Basketball Championship. Despite their astounding 112-7 record, the Rens stood before 3,000 mostly white fans cheering against them. Victory would prove that given equal opportunity, African Americans could compete with anyone. Robert Smilin' Bob Douglas had immigrated from St. Kitts in 1901, working as a doorman for $4 weekly. When the Renaissance Casino and Ballroom opened in 1923, he struck a deal: practice space in exchange for a percentage of admissions. Thus was born the first Black-owned, full-salaried professional basketball team. The Wren's rivalry with the original Celtics captivated fans and symbolized larger racial tensions. Their 1939 championship victory transcended sport. It demonstrated excellence that couldn't be denied. Years later, Joe Lapchick's son Richard shared his father's admission: "The Wrens were every bit as good as we were in the beginning and were better than us in the end." Born in Harlem in 1947, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar moved away at age 3, but returned as a teenager after his high school basketball coach used a racial slur during a championship game, claiming it was motivation. That moment shattered his trust and forced him to confront racism's pervasiveness. In summer 1964, instead of attending basketball camp, Abdul-Jabbar joined the Harlem Youth Action Project under historian Dr. John Henrik Clark. At the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, he discovered countless African-American achievements in medicine, literature, science, philosophy, systematically omitted from his schoolbooks. He learned two crucial lessons. One must apply historical knowledge to improve one's community, and self-education is vital because traditional education presents limited Eurocentric perspectives. Abdul-Jabbar credits several writers who shaped his thinking: Langston Hughes, whose jazz-influenced poetry his UCLA coach John Wooden would recite; Zora Neale Hurston, who documented Black folk stories despite criticism; James Baldwin, who distilled Renaissance themes in Sonny's Blues; and Chester Himes, whose Harlem crime novels portrayed the full spectrum of Black life. That summer transformed Abdul-Jabbar from a talented teenager into a conscious intellectual athlete. Like Isaac Newton, we see further by standing on giants' shoulders. The Harlem Renaissance created those giants, artists, musicians, writers, and athletes who refused to accept America's limited vision of Black possibility. They understood that excellence could accomplish what legislation couldn't, changing hearts and minds through undeniable achievement. Jazz didn't eliminate racism, but it gave America its own musical identity. As generations grew up with jazz and its descendants, rock and roll, R&B, soul, rap, hip-hop, each generation shed one more skin of racism. The Renaissance succeeded by creating excellence that demanded recognition. When the Cotton Club admitted Black patrons, when publishers sought Black writers, when basketball teams integrated, these weren't gifts. They were acknowledgments of value that could no longer be denied. Today's challenges, systemic inequalities, cultural appropriation, narratives needing correction, require what the Renaissance taught us. Progress demands both excellence and activism, both art and argument. As Ron Karanga says, our youth can be our fate or our future. The revolution isn't finished. It's waiting for us to pick up where they left off.